Okay, I'd like to go ahead and continue with Ephesians chapter 1, starting in verses 4. We've gone over 4, just the tail end of that, so here we go. All right, going over this quickly, this review. I hope it's not getting to be tiresome, at least my presentation of it. The prologue extends from verse 3 to 14. It includes praise to God for every spiritual blessing. It mentions ideas for later development in the epistle. These blessings include God's choice of us, predestination to adoption as His children, redemption from sin, revelation of the mystery of His will, and an inheritance. These are great blessings. Just imagine what it would be to be without these blessings, especially, you know, at the end of our lives on the day of judgment, not to have these things. Paul's language here is designed to excite the sensibilities and sensitivities of his audience to the realities of God's spiritual blessings. In fact, the scholars say that that's the reason that he had such a long sentence there, 202 words in just one sentence, because he was trying to bring out this idea of just how blessed we are by God. There's a lot more to Ephesians than a cursory reading of it will show. Some ideas in it can be construed to support insidious theologies. Let's proceed with caution. And by the way, when I've been talking about a certain theology, you know, that's not the name of a particular church. I haven't named any church and attacking some church. I haven't done that, but the theology I have named. And it's kind of a trans-church theology. Anyway, let's go ahead. As I said, we've gone over this first verse here, verse 3, but I need to include that. What I haven't done is to cover this. And I want to make sure I don't leave that out, because it is important. But I need to have the whole thing here to get the context, to get the idea. Paul says in verse 3, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places in Christ, just as He chose us in Him before the foundation of the world, that we would be holy and blameless before Him." Okay, so we've covered all these other ideas in those two verses, except for this last part here. And as I say here, this is a good example here in yellow. This is a good example of an idea in the prologue that will be elaborated on later in Ephesians. Chapters 4 through 6 will develop it. And if you start reading chapter 4, you'll see where Paul talks about the way that we walk, that we shouldn't walk as the Gentiles, as the other Gentiles do, in the vanity of their minds and their dark and all of this, and we should put away all these things. So, chapters 4 through 6, he's going to develop this whole idea of how we ought to respond in light of all the blessings that God has given us. Holy and blameless in His sight. That Greek word there is translated before Him, before. But it really, if you look right there in the middle, ope right there, it has to do with the eye, like an optometrist. So in His eye, in His sight, He is watching us day in and day out, and we want to walk a certain way. We want to be affected. Our walk ought to be affected by what God has done for us. And we ought not to just take it easy because we're in God's grace and therefore we can kind of slack off. No, that's not what Paul is talking about here. So, God sees all that we do, and is it really acceptable to Him? As He would not accept an animal for sacrifice that had a blemish, neither will He accept our blemishes. And so It's a very good thing, isn't it, that if we are in the unblemished one, then we are unblemished. I've got all kinds of blemishes, moral blemishes, which I hope I'm growing in sanctification, that I'm continually repenting, reforming, but I'll never get to the point where there are no imperfections in me. And so it's a good thing that we have this unblemished one. He is the sacrifice. He's the lamb. He's the ox or whatever that is offered for us. So it's a good thing that we have him. Now going on to the next verse, verse 5. In love, he, God, predestined us to adoption as sons through Jesus Christ to himself, according to the kind intention of his will. And I have here in red, I have a little note for me. It's not for you. It's just to kind of prod my memory as to what I need to say. So please don't even see it. Telling versus showing. As a teacher, as an English teacher, a writing teacher, you know, I spend a lot of time telling my students, you know, the difference between telling and showing. And so if you're just going to write an essay, you're going to write a paragraph, part of that paragraph is going to be a telling part. The other part's going to be the showing part. So the telling part is going to be the topic sentence. And the showing or the proving, substantiating part is going to be all those details, giving the details. Well, there's more kind of literature or writing than just a paragraph. You've got narratives, where a story is full of telling words, details that help the imagination to see what was going on, what's going on. I enjoy stories and narratives and things like that. But this right here, an epistle, a letter, not going to have that showing part. Almost all of it's going to be telling. And so it's just going to be full of concepts, abstractions, not doing things where you can actually use your imagination and see something going on. And so it's kind of hard for us, and when we read these things that Paul is writing, to get in too much involved in it. It's, it would help perhaps when we're reading about God, how God is love and how kind he is, to maybe let our imagination go back to the Old Testament and all the kindness that he showed to his people as he protected them as they were going through the desert. He fed them from the heavens. He fed them bread and he gave them doves or quails to eat. And then, of course, when he sent his son, Jesus. And we can see Jesus on his way to the cross and upon the cross. And all of this would help us to understand this a little bit more and be a little bit more sensitive to these words here, these concepts, love and kind intention. Okay, now, he's talking about adoption. We are adopted as sons or children, which would certainly include daughters. Adoption in the Greco-Roman world was very different from adoption in our world. A disinherited son was one that was rejected by a father for wrongs that he had done. An alienated son, back in ancient times, was a son given by one father to another for adoption. So in both cases, the fathers were still alive, and yet they were able to be adopted by someone else. And so this alienated son was one that was given to another father for adoption while his biological father was still alive. This was something that, a custom that actually existed back in those days. The primary interest was for inheritance. That son, when he grew up and became a man, would inherit everything that his new father had, and often the father was very wealthy. Adoption was often within an extended family. So you have Scipio, I think. He was the Carthaginian general, I believe, who fought against Hannibal, you know. And he was adopted. Octavius, who became Augustus Caesar. He was adopted by Julius Caesar. I think he was something like a nephew, a great nephew, something like that. So he was from an extended family. And you can understand that most of these adoptions were adoptions by a father of probably somebody in the family for whom they had some affinity. They had feelings for them. They cared about them. They wanted them to become their son. Yet God adopted us when we were alienated from him. We were his enemies. And when he adopted us, we become co-heirs with his son. We are raised up in the heavenly places to sit with him on his throne. This is what Paul means when he says, in love, he predestinated us as sons, according to the kind intention of his will. It's really amazing, isn't it? Okay, going on to the next verse. We're actually moving from verse to verse now. Yes, thank you, Flame. Okay, Ephesians 1:6. To the praise of his glory. He adopted us to the praise of his glory, which he freely bestowed on us in the beloved. Well, the Apostle Peter, another writer. This is not Paul here, but this is 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9. This is a passage I think a lot about as to why am I here? What is the purpose of life? What is our cardinal purpose of life? And Peter tells us here, he says, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. That is what we're here for. That is what our purpose is in life. More than any other thing, it is to talk about, to rhapsodize about God's excellencies. And that word in the Greek there is the word for virtue, his virtues. We should be talking about that all the time. That's what it means, I think, to be a believer. And look at the kinds of things that he has done for us here, even in what Peter's talking about here. He says, you're a chosen race. Now, these terms here were originally applied to Israel, weren't they? Israel was a chosen race, and we've already taken up that idea of God's choosing us, haven't we? Paul has already talked about that in verse 3 of this chapter. And so you see that it's possible for God to choose someone, to make a corporate choice, isn't it? Not just an choosing individuals. But here, Israel was corporately chosen, was it not? And what is the new Israel? What is the spiritual Israel today? Well, it's the church, isn't it? It's we. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession. Involved in all of these things from the Old Testament are lots of blessings. And on the basis of that, we ought to be proclaiming God's excellencies, who called us out of darkness. Darkness. People who live in darkness, they don't know why are we here? Is there a meaning in life? Is there a point or a purpose in our life? The rest of the world who don't believe in God, who are not his children, are lost, aren't they? They're just completely lost. They don't know why they're here. Is there any meaning to life? But we are different. In Matthew 3:17, Matthew says, "And behold, a voice out of the heaven said, 'This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased.'" And so when Paul refers to Jesus as the beloved, he may have this passage here in mind. When Jesus rose up out of the Jordan River after he was baptized, and there you see him there, using your imagination, you see him dripping with water from his baptism, and the heavens opened, and this voice comes out, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." What an image that is. We are in the same situation. As he was anointed, so we have an anointment. You know, in the Old Testament, when they anointed someone, a king or a prophet or somebody like that, they would pour oil over their heads, and it would come down their hair, down over their bodies and all. They were anointed. Well, this is kind of like that. Baptism is kind of like that, isn't it? Okay, moving on to the next verse. Verse 7. "In him we have redemption." I was thinking of that song that Evan led. We are redeemed. "In him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of our trespasses, according to the riches of his grace." Well, the concept of redemption echoes the ancient marketplace and the Old Testament. Those people to whom Ephesians would be read, most of them couldn't read. And of those who could read, very few of them could write. And those who could write usually couldn't write very well. Maybe that's why Paul employed an amanuensis, a secretary, to do almost all of his writing for him. And so at the ends of several of his epistles, he would write in large letters, probably like an elementary school child, you know, making big letters. It may not be because he couldn't see. It may be because he just couldn't write very well. And so they would employ professional secretaries like Silvanus. Silvanus, or Silas, was another name. He was probably one of these better writers. And so not only Paul, but also Peter employed or used Silvanus to write his letters, probably others as well. Anyway, to those people, the concept of redemption, this would be something they were very familiar with, redemption in the ancient marketplace. People in those days who were kidnapped and slaves were often redeemed. You know, we have kidnapping going on, the taking of hostages taking place even today. Over there in Somalia, you know, people on ships, these boats would come out, and these guys with these automatic weapons would come along and board the ship and take people hostage. And then we'd have to give them millions of dollars to get them back. This is the same kind of thing. Happens today, but it happened a lot back in those days. And not only was redemption for people who were kidnapped, but also for slaves. Those slaves would often be family members. If you had enough money, you could buy them out of their slavery. Redemption in the Old Testament was tied to release from bondage in Egypt. In Exodus 13, verse 13, it says, "But every first offspring of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb, and every firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. And it shall be, when your son asks you in time to come, saying, 'What is this? What's this about?' Then you shall say to him, 'With a powerful hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt, from the house of slavery.'" It came about when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go that the Lord killed every firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. "Therefore, the Father says to the Son who asks him, "Therefore, I sacrifice to the Lord the males, the first offspring of every womb, but every firstborn of my sons I redeem." I redeem with a lamb or some other animal. And doesn't the language of 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 23, anticipate Ephesians 1, 6, which talks where Paul is talking about redemption? In that chapter, Samuel says, "And what one nation on the earth is like your people Israel?" No, this is David speaking. I'm sorry, he's writing it. David says, "And what one nation on the earth is like your people Israel, whom God went to redeem for himself as a people, and to make a name for himself, and to do a great thing for you, and awesome things for your land, before your people, whom you have redeemed for yourself from Egypt, from nations, and their gods." Now notice, before we pass on here to another slide, that this is like Ephesians 1 verse 6, only it's in Old Testament terms, because in verse 6 of Ephesians 1, God is being praised, God is being glorified because of his redemption of the new Israel. And here you see him being glorified here. "And to make a name for himself." And God did make a name for all that he did in bringing Israel out of the land of bondage through the plagues and the dividing of the Red Sea or the Sea of Reeds and all of that. "And to do a great thing for you, for God, and awesome things for your land, before your people whom you have redeemed for yourself from Egypt, from nations and their gods." Now notice, it's not just from Pharaoh, it's not just from the land of Egypt, but the gods, the Egyptian gods also were involved in this redemption. Being redeemed, being rescued, being released from the gods of Israel, of Egypt. Let's not forget about that. You know, and when we get into chapter 6 of Ephesians, we're going to be reading about the principalities and powers and the thrones and all of these entities, these supernatural entities that really do exist in the heavenly places. And what are they doing? Are they just sitting? Are they idle? They don't have any force, any power? Of course, they have all kinds of power. And Paul is going to be telling his readers to arm themselves against those gods. They really were God. There's a hierarchy of supernatural entities in the heavenly places. They're not all angels. They're not all messengers who do God's bidding. But they have great power. And I believe, and Paul certainly says that in Ephesians 6, that they somehow intersect with us, with our world, certainly with our rulers, with us. And so they were released from those gods, and those who are redeemed by the blood of the Lamb today are released from the gods that we are have conflicts with. Okay, verse 7. "In him," in Christ, "we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of our trespasses, according to the riches of his grace." Well, I have a little couple of notes there on the slide just to prod my memory. I want to make sure that we understand here that this expression here, "the forgiveness of our trespasses," is an appositive. It's an appositive phrase. If you remember your English grammar, an appositive was a name, a noun, that renamed a noun that went before it. So if I say, "Our dog Piper did such and such," well, Piper is an appositive for dog, for the word dog. Okay? And so it just renames something that goes before it. It's another name. And that's what we have here. Paul intends for this expression to rename this. But then you say, wait, hold on there, Brother Reed. Those are two different things, aren't they? How can you say that this, forgiveness of our trespasses, is just another name for redemption through his blood? Isn't redemption different from forgiveness? Well, you'd be surprised. Let's go on down and see what this word really is. Should it be translated forgiveness? Well, the forgiveness of our trespasses isn't a positive phrase, and I've gone over that. But when Paul uses ophesis, this is the word here for forgiveness, ophesis, his thought is more about release from sin as a power than about the forgiveness of sins and their indictment. Okay? A better translation, according to these scholars, would be the release from our trespasses. And that would kind of go along with those Old Testament allusions that we've been reading about, how that they were released from the bondage of Egypt. Here's where the word ophesis occurs in the New Testament, and very, very significantly. In Luke 4, verse 18, Luke says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me." This is Jesus speaking now. He stands up in the synagogue, remember? All the eyes are glued upon him. They've been hearing about him. Maybe he's been doing some miracles. And he stands up and he says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives." Okay, so here, this word ophesis, which is up here in Ephesians, is properly translated, release to the captives. When Paul discusses forgiveness of sins, he uses another word. And this is, only once or twice, maybe twice, Paul uses the word ophesis. And all the times he talks about forgiveness of sins, he uses this word here, charizomai, from the word charis, which means grace. So, charizomai means to be gracious toward, or to cancel out something, to remit, and then it can also mean to forgive. But it means to be gracious toward, to be propitious toward it. Okay? We see this idea of ophesis as release in the sister epistle. And I've tried to argue that Colossians is kind of like a sister epistle to Ephesians. They talk about basically the same things. And they were written in the same time, same place. A sister epistle to Ephesians in Colossians chapter 1, verses 13 and 14. "For he rescued us," Paul says, "from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins." Well, doesn't that echo what Paul just said in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 7? Here you have this very same expression here. Forgiveness here is ophesis, which is more like release, as the context seems to reveal. Being released from the domain, like being released from Egypt. Note that redemption and release is associated with the domain of darkness. The Israelites were also redeemed from the gods of Egypt. Okay, so let's keep that idea of the power and the authority of the gods in view as we go through Ephesians. We usually don't talk that much about it or preach or teach that much about the unseen realm, but they are there, and I believe that they daily have to do with our daily lives, you know. Watching something on TV right before we got here, and I was telling Karen, I said, it's just like those gods up there have opened up the skulls of the people, you know, and just pouring their propaganda right down into their heads, you know, because it's just coming right out of their mouths. So yes, they do. We have a lot to do with them. Okay, finally then, the summary. God chose us to be blameless and unblemished before Him. And I think there in Revelation chapter 12, where the writer there, John, says that, you know, that the accuser of our brethren, Satan himself, has been cast down. He's been cast down, and they have overcome him by the blood of the Lamb. So this is how we're blameless and unblemished. As imperfect as we are, our accuser's not up there before God's throne anymore, saying, hey, you saw what he said? Do you see what he's doing? You know? No. He's not there anymore. He's not standing there before God's throne blaming us, accusing us. And why? Because of this right here, the blood of the Lamb. He predestined us for adoption while we were his enemies. That's a great thing. In love, he says, according to his kind intention, he adopted us. So that we're not strangers and aliens, but we are God's own children. We ought to be proclaiming his excellencies in light of his kindnesses toward us. God has redeemed us from our bondage as he redeemed ancient Israel from their bondage to Egypt. Paul ties forgiveness of sins to redemption so that ophesis means release more than forgiveness to Paul and his use of the terms. And finally, how would a slave in those days have felt when he or she heard these words about release from bondage? Can you imagine what it would have been like to be a slave back in those days, sitting there? I was going to say, obviously they couldn't read, but that's not true. No, a lot of those slaves were well-educated, and they even tutored the children of patrician, you know, people that are wealthy. But a lot of them, of course, couldn't read. But can you imagine one of them sitting there listening to Paul's letter to the Ephesians or to the Colossians, where he's talking about freedom from bondage and all of that? There's a tradition that one of those slaves by the name of Onesimus, remember that he was a slave over there around Colossae, who ran away from his master, Philemon. Now, Philemon was a Christian, and he ran all the way over to Rome, where Paul was in prison. And he got to know Paul. Paul got to know him. Maybe he became a Christian there. I don't know. No, nobody knows when he became a Christian. Onesimus, whose name means useful. And so Paul sends him back with a letter trying to get him to treat Onesimus well and to take him back and so forth. Well, the tradition is that Onesimus became an elder of that church, of the church there. Now, try to imagine that. You know, here's Onesimus, a slave, and I don't know about Philemon, his master. Was he an elder? Maybe he wasn't. But here's Onesimus, an elder, and maybe Philemon that's not. How would that work? You know, what would be their relationship? But it's a great thing, you know, that the gospel has this liberating power, this force, so that even if you're a slave, you're equal to, you're the same as, you're a brother of, even your master. And those kinds of issues of slave and master and husband and wife and so on will be addressed later. Okay? That's all I have to say. Any comments or questions? Okay? Well, thank you very much.